Welcome. You are listening to Our Burning Questions, a professional learning podcast where we ask brilliant educators everything you've ever wondered about teaching English language learners. I'm your host, Liesl Koop. I'm an ENL teacher and resource specialist with the Mid-State Regional Bilingual Education Resource Network in Syracuse, New York. Thanks for joining us. Welcome back, listeners. I'm excited to share our topic with you today. We have one question. Our burning question for today is, does my student need speech therapy, some kind of special education support, English language development support, or both? And to talk about this question, I have two specialists, two experts in the field who are going to kind of work through this question with us. And I'm going to let them introduce themselves. Today I have Kelly Burt and Lourdes Roa. Hello.
Hi.
So I'll start with you, Kelly. Kelly, can you tell our guests, our listeners, what your role is currently?
Sure. My name is Kelly Burt, and I am a speech-language pathologist by trade. I practiced in a clinical setting for over 9 years before shifting into professional development role with OCM BOCES out of the Syracuse area. And my specialty in professional learning and professional development has landed in the areas of multi-tiered systems of support, social-emotional learning, and culturally responsive and sustaining education. And so I've also been doing some work with Arburn and collaborating on this really important question regarding speech therapy and English language learners.
Awesome. And do you have any particular areas of special interest?
I mean, I guess the ones that I listed, my heart is definitely with MTSS and social emotional learning and that culturally affirming and responsive environment for all of our students. So I guess you could say the work that I do is the work that I'm especially interested in.
Well, that's good. That's not everybody gets to say that. So that's awesome. And Lourdes, hi.
Hi.
Can you tell our listeners what your role is, what position you hold right now?
Right. Currently, okay, so my name is Lourdes Roa, and currently I'm the director at the Midwest Arburn at Monroe 2 Orleans BOCES, and we're located in Spencerport, New York. I've been here for 5 years. Prior to this, I was an administrator at a dual language charter school, and I've worked as an administrator in Rochester City School District in the ELL department at the time. That's what we called it. And prior to that, I was a bilingual special education teacher and teacher trainer. I worked with the former CETRIC, which became RSD TAS. But I've been doing bilingual education since 1982. So that's a long time. I got into my little special education in 1991 when I moved back to New York State after my first few, 7 years of teaching.
Wow.
So my areas of interest, so special education is near and dear to my heart. Yes, I've been doing administration for the last, I would say, 10 years. Possibly 15 now, gosh, time flies. 15 years I've been doing administration, but in the world of bilingual, dual language, working with ELLs, I myself am a second language learner. I was born in Cuba. I'm a refugee. My family came in the early 60s. And I knew since I was in third grade, I wanted to be a teacher. And this field kind of just has evolved for me. I too, like Kelly said, the culturally responsive and sustaining piece to me is even more hidden and more of an intrigue and an interest to me because those are some of the things that impacted me as I was growing up. Mm-hmm. The language as well. I was a Spanish speaker, forgot my Spanish, became an English speaker, and then started to develop my Spanish again. I would call myself English dominant, even though we don't like to use the word dominant so much anymore. Although I am bilingual, my proficiency is because professionally I use English a lot more, but I do maintain my Spanish and I love being bilingual. So that's why I work in this field. And I, like Kelly, am very lucky that I do what I love and love what I do. So at Arbern, our focus is general education ELLS, but I can't forget who I am, so I bring that to the table as well. And I work with my colleagues at the RPC now at Monroe One.
Awesome. Thank you.
So
we're going to kind of jump into some questions that support our burning question for today. So I want to start, Kelly, with you. Maybe you could just describe to our listeners who don't necessarily know in detail, what is the overall role of a school-based speech-language pathologist? Because I know that I don't 100% know.
It's actually a really good question, because when you fall into the idea of becoming a speech and language pathologist and you go to school, like many fields, you can leave with a master's degree in speech language pathology and work in a huge variety of settings. I've spent time in acute care and hospital settings. I have friends who work in nursing homes in more of a medical type setting. I have friends who work in private practice. You can work with kids, you can work with adults, you can work with infants in the NICU. So there's a lot of ways that this can go. So the term SLP is pretty challenging if you don't know exactly what you're talking about. So a school-based SLP is really designed to be there to support the school environment. A school-based speech-language pathologist focuses on screening, assessment, and identification of potential communication delays for students that might have an impact on their ability to be successful in the school environment. And that can include things like academic concerns, social concerns, literally anything that might involve speech, language, or communication. They also work toward planning and provision of those intervention services. So if we do find that students are experiencing a communication delay in some way that impacts their education and their ability to function in that environment, we then provide services. And that can look a ton of different ways. We can push into the classroom. We can pull out and do individual or small group therapy. It kind of depends on the child and their needs. And we can address a variety of things. Articulation, which is more like those speech sounds. The kids that you normally, you know, when you hear somebody say, oh, they don't say their R's right, or they have a lisp. Things like that can fall into place. Language concerns, which is huge, and that can fall into a range of receptive language, which is the way we understand language, or expressive language, which is the way that we communicate outwardly. We can also address issues of fluency, which is more commonly called stuttering. So if you've got a kid who engages in that, we can address that. Voice concerns, pragmatics or social communication, and even issues with dysphagia, or what we might call feeding or swallowing for students if it impacts their ability to be engaged in their school environment. And in reality, school-based SLPs are really cool because they can be involved in both regular education and in special education. In regular education, we can do some outreach and proactive and preventative work. Maybe SLPs pop into classrooms and work on phonemic awareness skills and phonological awareness skills and kind of get in with the younger kids and help expand those opportunities. They're also part of the RTI process, which is response to intervention, which is actually a gen ed initiative. And we can be a part of the special education process if students are determined to be eligible for special education. So they kind of run the gamut in a school setting, for sure.
Okay, so as I'm listening to you describe all these things, I'm like, okay, this is going to get really hairy, because all the things you're talking about, I'm like, yes, as an ENL teacher, yes, I do those yes. things too. So I'm like, oh no, yes. This is going to get tricky.
And that's why we're here, right? That's why we're asking these questions.
Right. So let me think about what's going to be most helpful for the listeners. If it's okay with both of you now, I kind of want to jump over to Lourdes. And maybe, Lourdes, you can speak to the role of an ENL teacher and the role of a bilingual special education specialist, if you would be willing to kind of take on both of those, so that we can hear from your perspective what might be the same or what might be different from what Kelly just described for an SLP.
It's funny because, you know, it is, this is why there's an overrepresentation of ELLS in that are classified as speech and language delayed, because it's so similar, and it really takes, I think, someone with a deeper understanding of language development for second language learners to understand those predictable limitations for someone learning a second language. you know, Kelly mentioned, you know, dropping the R's. Well, if you speak your home language and you've been speaking many years and the R is not a sound in your language, it's very hard to pronounce it. Absolutely. And that is predictable and typical. That doesn't necessarily mean that there's an impairment of some kind. So the role of the ENL teacher and the bilingual specialist is to really understand that language development piece, the language acquisition process, what students go through, and also the cultural implications of where they come from and how adjusting to a new environment, a new country, a new school system might also impact them social, emotionally, and academically, and just how they approach school. So those are some things. I think the key thing is that understanding that difference. In for a speech language pathologist, they're looking at students that are limited in comparison to students in that same language group. And you know, it's important that if a student has a language delay, they have that delay in their home language. It's not a delay that just shows up in second language. So having someone that can speak that child's language to assess, is this, you know, having the parents involved, oh yes, these are the problems we see at home with language development. So that those are some key things. And I really believe strongly that we need to work together when we're looking at children in terms of, is this a delay that's typical for a language learner who's developing a second, third language, or is this a delay that we're seeing in a home language situation?
Thank you for that. And I want to later talk about the level of overwhelm that I know I've felt as an ENL teacher working with a special education teacher or an SLP trying to hash this out. I want to really acknowledge that later as we get through some of this information, because I know that I can hear my colleagues saying, and I've heard myself say, like, well, I can't know every language. How am I going to know if that is like a language-based thing or if there's some kind of disorder? So we'll talk about that in a minute. Kelly, could you talk about some of the types of disorders that an SLP might notice or be able to identify in a student, whether they're monolingual English speaker or not?
Yep. And yes, absolutely. And like Loris was telling us, we do have to be mindful that depending on whether or not the student is monolingual or bilingual, some of this assessment and intervention might look different. So when I answer this question, I'm going to answer it in generality first. And then we can talk about what that might look like in terms of difference and what we need to be mindful of for our bilingual or English language learning students. So when I first became a speech therapist, the common thread was, you know, oh, I'm going to be a speech therapist, and oh, you help kids fix their lisp. You help kids who stutter, right? And it's actually much larger than that. And I think one of the important pieces that I tend to talk to folks about is the breakdown of the difference between what is a speech disorder, what is a language disorder, because those are actually two very different things, and what is an overall communication disorder, because in fact, all three of those things are a little bit different, but yet for most people who don't work in this field, you might, you know, be more willing to kind of interchange those terms, and in fact, they're not actually interchangeable. When we think about a speech disorder, that is limited in particular to the articulation of specific speech sounds. So like when people talk about a child who may lisp or has trouble with their R's or L's or any other particular sound, that also includes fluency and stuttering or potentially voice. So we want to make sure that we're, you know, piecing that up, apart there. And like Loris was telling us, when we're thinking about a child who might potentially be an English language learner, the speech sound thing can kind of come into play pretty significantly, because if there are sounds that are not normally present in their first language, we have to be really, really careful about how we assess that and move forward. If we're talking about a monolingual speaker where the child only speaks English and doesn't have exposure to other languages, you're going to look at it a little bit differently. It depends on the norms for speech development in the person's native language, because there are norms for that. The other piece is a language disorder. So language is separate from speech. Speech is like, it's kind of the motor aspects. It's how we put together sounds. It's how, you know, the fluency of our speech. Language is that comprehension and use of spoken, written, or other symbol systems. So it might have an impact on the form of language. So our phonology, our morphology, our syntax, those include things like grammar and the way that we put sounds together to form words and the meaning behind all of that. And in terms of the meaning, that's the content piece, right? The actual content of the language. What do these words mean that I'm putting together and putting out there for folks? And then another piece of that is the function of language. We might call that pragmatics or social skills. Okay, I can put all these words together and I've got grammar and I've got, you know, my vocabulary is going okay, but can I actually use it to communicate intent? Can I use that to comment, protest, ask questions, and engage with others? And in theory, if you have one or both of those, a speech disorder and or a language disorder, that can fall under the umbrella category of a communication disorder, right? Because if we have difficulty producing the sounds that are necessary for speech, which could potentially make it difficult for others to physically understand the words that we're saying, or if we have a language disorder and have trouble putting together grammatical structures, forming sentences, creating sentences that have solid meaning, it will make it very difficult for us as individuals to communicate with each other, whether it's to participate in school academically or to engage with others in a social context. So while we've got those three different things, we've got communication disorder, we've got language disorder, and we've got speech disorder, they really are separate things. And I don't think that's a common understanding that those can be different.
Wow. And my mind is like blown about how large the scope of the work is.
Yes, it is a very large scope, yes.
And just thinking about like, how do you support somebody if they have a language disorder in that area of pragmatics, for example? Like, that is like blowing my mind. Like, I can't even imagine, like, okay, where do I begin? That's huge. That's huge. Wow. Okay.
You go to school for a lot of years.
I'm just processing. So Lourdes, when you're looking at that and you've had experience with these areas as well, what kind of stands out to you as what's similar for the role of an English language development teacher, and what is different?
It's you were saying that, you know, I was thinking that often ENL teachers are not seen as clinicians, which speech language pathologists are, and yet you have similar skills in supporting communication and language patterns. And you have tools in your toolbox to help children develop that second language. It's not that they have a disorder, it's that you are helping take them to the next level. So, you know, sometimes we don't know what we know, right? And we're like, it becomes second nature to ENL teachers, bilingual teachers as well. One of the things that I was thinking, as Kelly was talking, I was thinking, wow, listening to all the levels, it is very rare, and yet we know it's best practice for speech services to be provided in the student's home language, right? And so districts that have bilingual programs, large numbers of students that speak a particular language, to find a speech language pathologist that understands that first language, the sounds, the language patterns, and for communication purposes, to be able to do all those three layers of therapy, you know, that's rare. And you could see what my thought was, we often default to a speech therapist working with an ENL teacher to provide speech language pathology. When we're just doing speech therapy in English for a lot of our second language learners, we can misread, there could be miscues, there needs to be real close alliance, I believe, with the speech professional as well as the language expert, whether it's a bilingual special ed teacher. I don't know if this is the right time to talk about it, but when I was a bilingual special education teacher, I taught in two different kinds of programs, a 15-1 and a 12-1-1. I I had a lot of integrated services. I would meet, and I was a classroom teacher. I would meet with my ENL teacher and my speech language pathologist. We did our planning together, the three of us, monthly. We had monthly themes, and then we chose when they would be coming into the room and the different things that we could do in stations together. And then they would also talk about times that they needed to take the students into their own classrooms to do their own specific targets. The speech language pathologist needed to meet the goals on the IEP. The ENL teacher needed to work on specific skills and break the students up into small groups. Because even though I had 15 students that were all L's, we know they're not all learning the same thing in ENL. They are at different proficiency levels. So those kinds of collaborations, I think, are key. Mm. And there isn't a quick, easy recipe of how that works. So it really is complex, and I think that's where you can get that overwhelmed feeling. But if professionals can come together, whether it be at the CSE meeting or, you know, after the CSE meeting, anytime, and say, okay, what can we do as we're looking at this student? Let's say Carlos. We want to look at Carlos, and these are some of the things I'm seeing in speech. These are some things I'm seeing in the bilingual classroom or in ENL, either one. And say, how could we come together to really support that student the best way possible?
So. The other thing I, when I was still in primarily clinical practice, the other thing I tended to notice, especially when I was working with districts or programs who historically and traditionally had fewer students who spoke languages other than English, because the term speech language pathologist has the word language in it, they know that the child may be struggling and might need some support. But what I often found was, it was kind of like, well, we know we need to help this kid, but we don't know what else to do, so let's just give him speech. And so a lot of it comes down to not only collaborating with the professionals in your space, but also educating the professionals in your space, talking to your teachers and your TAs and even your CSE or CPSE chair people, principals, like, hey, this is what this looks like. This is how we need to support these students so that they're not feeling like they're floundering for what to do to support a kid, because in the end, that's what's important is the kid. And a lot of times they were simply with the best intentions just trying to help, but it doesn't necessarily meet the need the right way. And so how do we not only collaborate with our professionals when we do realize that a child who speaks a second language also has a disability, but how do we educate the people around us and in our spaces to be able to make sure that they also have an understanding of what requires a speech language pathologist and what requires an ENL teacher or potentially requires both?
Okay, so let's talk about that. Oh, Lourdes, you want to say something?
As a parent. I remember many parents come to me and say, my child needs speech. And it was, my dad as an immigrant, I remember he said, when he first came to this country, he worked for Goodwill Industries. And the folks that worked with him all had a disability of some kind. And they would say, well, what's yours? And he would say, my tongue. Because he saw that he thought he had a disability. Mm-hmm. And quickly he learned English and moved on to be an accountant for a corporation. But it's that kind of thing that parents also can misinterpret and say, my child needs speech. Yeah. So it's just really educating everyone on the difference.
And I think the other piece of that family involvement is, are we as a program, as a school, as a building, as a classroom, letting parents know whose native language isn't English, that their native language is welcome in our school environment, that their native language is valued in our school environment. Because I've also seen that happen where either it's anxiety or they're anticipating that English just needs to be what this is. So they're going to jump right to something like speech therapy or fix this because we want our kid to speak English because that's what we think you as the teachers and as the educators expect from us. So how are we sending that message to families that you and your culture and your language are valued here and it's not a disorder, that your difference in language is not a disorder and we don't want to fix your child. We want to support your child in both languages so you can be successful.
Hmm. Amen, sister.
Yes, yes, I love that. And I think that
drop.
And we're done. No. I think that really brings up for me that we as the building teachers or even administrators, we need to know what we're talking about when families come in, and we need to have this information to say, look, here's what ENL means. Here's what a speech and language pathologist does. So let's like look at your child's individual situation and let's find out together like what is the best thing for that kid.
Team-based problem-solving process.
Exactly.
Works, yes.
So Kelly, I'm gonna kind of put you in the role of monolingual educator, and then if that's okay with you, and then I'm gonna have Lourdes kind of address the dual language or multilingual piece. So Kelly, what are some factors a teacher may notice that could be cause for a speech evaluation in a monolingual student?
In a monolingual student, there's usually a large range. And when we posed this potential question, as I started thinking about it, I said, okay, when I was in clinical practice and when I spent time in a school district as a school-based SLP, what were the common phrases or questions or comments that I'd hear from teachers when they started to be concerned? And keep in mind that sometimes the question that's raised or the concern that's raised for me often was dependent on sometimes the teacher's experience level, either with students who have speech and language disorders or what they know about speech and language development. So we have, you know, you kind of have to, you know, do a little bit of digging to know what teachers are experiencing so that they have an understanding of what's normal and what's not. But in terms of articulation or speech sounds, things that I would often, you know, whether it was email or passing in the hall, things I'd hear from teachers would be like, I'm really struggling to understand him or her. Like, I just can't figure out what they're saying. You know, they can't say this sound right. Everything seems to blend together. They repeat sounds and words a lot. I think he might stutter, right? So though, those are kind of red flags for me when they have concerns around speech or sound disorders or articulation disorders. When it comes to language, either receptive or expressive, the common things in a school setting that I hear often are, they really struggle to follow routines or directions, especially after that typical grace period, you know, because September is always pretty hard for kids as they come back in. But when they start noticing that kids are still struggling with following directions and following routines, when it's mid to late October, that's when they start asking questions. I usually get concerns around vocabulary, you know, grammatical structures being either wrong or not present altogether, difficulty answering questions or following along with the classroom lessons. Usually I hear from folks like, they just don't seem to process the information, or they seem to space out, or they can't quite seem to keep up. And the other piece that comes into play as kids move from like kindergarten and into first grade, and as they're addressing a lot of learning stuff regarding reading, the other things that I get are like, they can't seem to sound words out, the phonological awareness piece, the phonemic awareness piece. If they start having questions like that, that I might hear about it from a classroom teacher. The other piece could be the social part. If they have, especially for really young kids, so like if we've got kids who are, you know, still new to the school environment, if they have difficulty taking turns or sharing, difficulty initiating conversations, difficulty maintaining those conversational topics, either they jump around or they can't stray away from one particular topic. I also got a lot of interesting stuff around like, well, they seem to have a lot of meltdowns. They can't tell me how they're feeling. They can't process the emotion. So any of those in that social range. So again, a lot of stuff, which like you said before, it can sound really overwhelming because the scope is rather large, but those would be often the most frequent flyers of comments or concerns from general education teachers in that environment.
Thank you. Lourdes, for multilingual students, would we be looking for those same kind of indicators, or would we be looking for something different?
Well, I was listening, thinking, you know, they could be the same, but you would need to know, students in a bilingual environment where there's a teacher that speaks their home language and they're still having those same indicators, then you might want to go and pursue that. If they're in an English-only environment, you really want to see what happens if we start giving them some supports in the home language. Do some of those things change? are they able to be more, you know, I was thinking the behaviors, you know, the anxiety. Do we lower the anxiety so that students, you know, even students with multiply disabled students, you know, they can have some of these same anxious acting out behaviors when it's, you know, they're in an environment that is only English, and they don't know how to express themselves. So if you are able to give them either, they can understand someone speaking to them and say yes or no in their home language, and you see that anxiety lower, then you know it's not, you know, there are already some concerns with speech if they're nonverbal or whatever, but there's not, it, you know, some of these behaviors are being exhibited due to the language difference. So you really want to be able to provide some home language supports to determine how does that impact what you're seeing in the student. Now, it's hard because some of our students aren't coming in, you know, with a clean, I have in a monolingual Spanish-only environment to the age of 5, so I have no, you know, delays in Spanish. That isn't often the case. We have students that may have delays in their home language because they haven't been exposed to that either. So we have to determine, is it lack of exposure in the home language? Is it lack of exposure in English? It's very much peeling the layers back to determine what is really impacting here. So I have heard from one of my colleagues that there's some assessments out there that help determine that in multiple languages. The PVAT, I think Svetlana Stoll has mentioned that to me. I don't know, Kelly, if you're familiar with it. And she feels that that's a good one to help teachers start getting at some of these things that may be, you know, speech delay or language proficiency development issues.
So that's kind of a question that I know probably a lot of listeners would have, and I have. How do we give home language support if we're not teaching in a dual language program in order to determine, is this just language acquisition or is there some other kind of need here? How can we give home language support? I mean, I feel like if I'm thinking about my own experience, I could probably find some stuff out there for Spanish speakers. And we do have a lot of Spanish speakers in our region. But beyond that, what if I have a student who speaks Hindi or Urdu? Like, I don't know where to find resources for that. How do we support home language when we know how critical that is?
Well, I would say, you know, our Arborns are a good resource.
yes, we are.
We have, we're always putting together multiple language resources. And I'm seeing more and more, some of our districts that have, you know, I want to say, you know, 99 languages in the Rochester City School District. They might be up to over 100 now. But they are developing their libraries in their school libraries to have resources and getting the family involved, having community agencies involved to provide, you know, tutors, to provide, you know, you can have a student listen to a video in their home language about something that you're teaching. And it is maybe extra time, but once you develop those, keep them. You know, you're developing your lessons, your units, and you've got multiple language resources that you can just, you know, sprinkle in. And I don't want to make it sound haphazard because it's strategic. It's not, I say sprinkled in because you're not expected to translate everything. We get into that rut because I've had teachers that, you know, say to me, well, I translate everything. No, that is not language teaching, but maybe providing resources in the home language that are pivotal for the student to understand instruction and get some basic literacy foundation in their home language. If there's a book that you can send home and somebody at home reads in that language, what a huge, rich piece of resource it is, not only to get the parents more engaged, but for the student to find some support and come to school with background and understanding of a concept that they may not have had, or an idea that they could bring to class, and then develop their English around that. Did I answer the question?
Yes.
Yes.
Okay.
I have something to add to that too, because I think we can't stress enough Lourdes's point about involving the community and involving the family, because in reality, school can't be a silo. We've been learning as the years go on that schools are no longer able to be functional as individual silos. They are a part of a greater community, and it is our job as educators to be moving these children toward being successful adults, which means they're going to go out away from our schools and into the communities eventually. So are we bridging gaps and making connections with community resources that are out there? Do we know that any exist? And if you don't know about them, why? Ask yourself, why? Why don't I know about these? What is out there? And bringing in that family piece there. And I know my primary area of expertise is within early learning. So my primary area of focus was always preschool through third grade. And especially with those younger crowds, caregiver coaching. I'm telling you right now, there's nothing more powerful than caregiver coaching, because those are the people that are spending the most time with that child. You spend a fair amount of time during the day with every student, but then they go home and they're with parents or grandparents or family members or whoever it is that's providing the care for that child. So it really is one of the most key parts of our jobs and our roles to be able to provide some coaching and some support to the family members so that they can continue that instruction and that support at home.
So let's talk about that a little bit more. Let's talk about how special educators or speech and language pathologists and the language teacher, ENL or bilingual educator, can collaborate for students who need both, who need special education support and need English language support. And we've talked a little bit about some ideas on how to do that, but do either of you want to share any other ways that you think these teachers could collaborate to benefit the students?
One thing I wanted to say about that, but I'm open to other ideas too, is just that there's a myth out there that one is more important than the other. And it could be for any student, anyone could say, well, my service is more important or my service is more important. And I think that we've got to be careful of that. And instead of saying my service is more important, say, you know, how can we come together? How can we work together? And I always am looking for examples out there of people that are working together in creative and innovative ways. You know, like I said, I have my experience, but that was a long time ago. And, stations in the classroom, integrating planning through units, in thematic units. I mean, I taught that way 20 years ago, because that's what we needed to do to be able to collaborate better. And so, I'm not sure that's always happening now, but I don't know, Kelly, maybe you have some experience or some ideas to share here.
One of my favorite ideas in that realm of teaming and collaborating, and whether it's a bilingual student or not, is if it's a child that we have designated as a student with a disability, team-based IEP goals. Because I see way too often that IEPs are written with, here's the reading goal and only the reading teacher assesses it. Here's the math goal and only the math teacher targets this. And we forget that it's not just about math or speech and language or this or that. This is a whole child. And how can we take a look at the why, right? Like you talked about, Lourdes, with peeling away the layers. What is really the core root cause of this child's concern? Because we might be writing a math goal, but is the math goal there because they have an overall language concern that's creating a difficulty with processing, you know, word problems? So what is actually at the root cause? What do we want to prioritize, right? Because if everything is a priority, then nothing is. I never want to see an IEP that has 10 goals on it, ever. No more than 3 to 5. And if we're thinking no more than 3 to 5, we have to work together as a team to say, what does this kid need most right now to be successful as a whole child? And how can we build these goals so that the entire team has the ability to address them?
There's a lot of power in that.
There is.
And I'm just thinking about how few CSE meetings I was invited to as an ENL teacher, and how many I had to ask to be a part of.
Go ahead, Lisa, because I think I have a reason for why that happens.
Well, and I think also part of it, part of what's coming up for me is the fact that I had very little training about what happens at a CSE or, you know, what happens with special education evaluations. And so that was something that I kind of had to learn on my own. And obviously I'm still not an expert, but I can kind of say like, okay, I know what an IEP looks like. I know what's going to happen at this meeting and I need to be there for my student. So that is a frustrating thing for me to reflect on. And what were you going to say, Lourdes?
I'm going to say that because there are no special education goals for ENL, because it's not considered a special education service. So if you're a bilingual special ed teacher, yes, you're writing goals for that student. And you might have some goals for Spanish, some goals for English, you know. But if you're ENL, if you're considered, that's not special ed, they're just going to, that's a separate thing.
That's too long.
Yeah. Yep. And that's silo. And so it just says, oh, okay, well, we're not going to worry about that, or we're not going to talk about it because it's not on the IEP. But I loved what Kelly said about really looking more holistically at the goals, all of the goals, mm-hmm. and not just having even counseling goals is another example. Just because a child has counseling goals doesn't mean that everyone that works with that child doesn't need to know what those goals are.
Absolutely.
And
it's going to need to self-regulate in the classroom just as much as they're going to need to self-regulate in the 30-minute counseling session they only have every other week.
Right. That's those are the kinds of things. So even though ENL is not on the IEP, quote unquote, a mandated service under Part 200, it needs to be discussed at the CSE. And then that ENL teacher should know all of the goals that that child is working on, so they can know how the best way to work with that child, as well as everyone else at the table to know the language development issues that the ENL teacher is bringing to the table. Mm-hmm. So I think those are key things that really need to take place. So how you determine at that meeting the collaboration and how things work will look different for every child.
Yeah. And I'm thinking about how much I could have learned from the SLPs and the Billings that I worked in. Like, why didn't we work together?
And you do, you have to have a speech language pathologist who also knows that it's important in their role to advocate for including the ENL teacher, for including the bilingual teacher, for making sure that you are not just a silo. And I think, unfortunately, because most of, at least in my experience, and this was obviously 15, 16 years ago, but when I went through college and internships and all of those things, when you get your degree in speech language pathology, it gives you the ability to do, like we talked about at the beginning, a range of different types of practice, but clinical practice is very, very different from school-based practice, because clinical practice is in a silo. Clinical practice is you sit in a room, you're one-on-one, you're doing drill work, you're getting it done, and you're there once a week and you're leaving. Whereas school-based practice is, how am I addressing the needs of this whole child so that they can be successful in this environment that I'm a part of? And so I think making sure that, you know, I think it's going to come back to eventually higher education as well, making sure that they're adequately preparing pre-service, you know, whether it's speech therapists or teachers or anything in the education world, that this world cannot be in silos. It can't. It can't be in silos and be functional.
And I do want to speak about that teacher preparation a little bit later. And something that I'm just thinking about that I wrote down in my notes as you both were speaking was, I'm curious how this process works in multilingual education systems. So schools where that is the standard and not monolingual English. So when we think about speech, the role of a speech and language pathologist, I'm just curious about what that training is like for a speech and language pathologist in a country where multilingual education is the standard. And I'm just gonna reflect on that and maybe do some Googling. Because that would be really interesting.
I would have to do some Googling on that as well.
Yeah, it'd be really interesting to know what their training involves. So When we think about our students who may need one or both of these types of support, how do you think speech and language pathologists and ENL teachers or bilingual teachers can advocate appropriately for those combined needs?
I'm going to start and say, know your research and know your regulations, because I can't tell you the number of times that I had to come very prepared with a piece of paper in my hand to say, this is what needs to happen, and here's the physical evidence why. Because it's unfortunate, because, you know, as an ENL teacher, as the speech language pathologist, in theory, you're the expert in what you know, but you're also not in charge of the meeting necessarily. And it depends on who your chairperson is. But sometimes there was plenty of cases where I walked into meetings where, unless I had a physical piece of evidence that proved that what I was suggesting was necessary or relevant, I couldn't get away with having it there. So in order to appropriately advocate, I had to bring the evidence to make sure that I could say, yes, this is true and it's needed, and here's why.
I agree with that. And at the same time, I also agree that we need to do a lot more training with the administration that are conducting the meetings and are conducting the CSEs and writing IEPs, you know, making sure there's an understanding of the regulations and the research, and how, you know, and I think helping people feel comfortable. It's not about, I think there's a little fear involved. Either, you know, there's fear of, I don't really know that world, so I'm just going to stay away, rather than leaning in and learning more. Mm-hmm. And there's also the fear of, well, what if her service ends up being more valuable than mine? I don't really know. I just have heard throughout the years different things of, well, we've never done it that way. That's, you know, I think it's about what Kelly said, know your research, your regulations, and then let's do lots of training on it.
Yeah. Go ahead, Kelly.
And to that point as well, one of the most powerful things I tended, as I worked through the years and kind of figured this out as I went, one of the more powerful ways I was able to do that was by setting up a pre-CSE meeting. I want to get the people together that are going to be at this table, and I want to have an open and honest and like a safe feeling discussion before we're physically at the table, like making decisions. Like, this is what I'm thinking about. What do you think? Let's brainstorm what this could look like, so that you're ready when you get to the table to advocate for those things, because you've already planned and talked about it.
That's a really good practice. And I don't think everyone does that. You know, schools get involved in it busy, and so sometimes you don't even know what the other person's going to say or what the goals are, and you're showing up at the meeting and you only see this little part of your student. Mm-hmm. So, but if you could have a pre-meeting, that's ideal.
Yeah. There's like many things about what you both just said that are really resonating with me. I remember feeling like, I don't know how this meeting works, going to my first several CSE meetings. Like, I don't know what they're going to want me to say. I don't know how this generally works for students. And Lourdes, relating to the piece that you talked about in terms of fear, I have definitely felt that with students, knowing that I can do what I'm trained to do as an ENL teacher, and I recognize my students' needs in terms of English language development. And I also realize that there's something here with this child that I am not equipped to support. And so then, what's the right avenue to protect my child's best interests? That was always kind of like the question that I had in my mind, like, okay, I see something here that I don't think has to do with English language development. So how am I going to reach out to somebody? Who's the right person to reach out to? How exactly do I say this? You know, all these things that go through the mind of probably both sides of the picture, right? Like, when you know you have a student who is multilingual and also may have some other needs, I think probably the experts on both sides of that are like, okay, how do we navigate this? Because it is so, I don't want to say convoluted, but there's so much overlap between that. And that is kind of scary, because I want to make sure that my student is getting exactly what they need, but I also don't want them to be put in a situation that detracts from the support that they need. So it's really tricky to navigate.
And I want to say here too, sometimes the regulations, if you're going to say, we're going to follow Part 154 to a T, and we're going to follow Part 200 to a T, and they start conflicting and rubbing up against each other because you don't have enough minutes in a day.
Yes.
Yeah. So that myth that one service is more important than the other, again, comes up, and you have to look at that. And I just think for me as a bilingual teacher, and yeah, I was fortunate enough to study special education, but I know that as a general ed classroom teacher, you really need to form alliances to be able to look at the student clearly, holistically, and forming those alliances where you just feel comfortable saying, you know, something really weird happened today and in standalone or even in integrated with the student, and I just wonder what's going on. You want to talk? Can I talk to you about it? You know, that informal kind of support is so important.
Yeah, that if knowing I have that relationship would really make it easier to kind of reach out, you know what I mean? Mm-hmm. And I just wanted to put in there that I just heard somebody say last week that one trumps the other. So this is not like a myth that has gone by the wayside. It is still out there alive and well, unfortunately. Oh, yeah. So.
And I think to your point, to that feeling of fear and that feeling of safety and that building relationship, that really, what that pulls me into is a lot of the other work that I do around multi-tiered systems of support and climate and culture, because really the climate and culture of the building and of the staff and the way that you build relationships with each other and the way that the people in the building interact really lays the foundation for how we're able to do our work outside of those silos, right? Breaking down those silos. Are we looking at the total climate and culture of our building? Do I feel safe approaching, you know, my administration and asking these questions? Do I feel like I am allowed to bring this new information to someone and not be shooed away because it's not as important as this other service or whatever it is? So are we also making sure that the climate and culture of our building is in a positive and affirming enough environment that we can have those conversations, right? Because there, again, layers upon layers upon layers when it comes to meeting student needs.
So let's like go back in time a little bit of time travel, and think about our teacher prep programs. And I really would love to hear about your experiences during your teacher prep programs when we think about students like we're talking about today. So particularly multilingual learners who may or may not need special education support and trying to determine that. So when we think about when we were in our teacher prep programs, when you came out of that, I want to know, well, I don't want to ask a yes or no question because those are boring. I wanted to say, did we feel prepared for meeting the needs of these students who may need both types of support? And then what did we not expect, or were we not taught about or told about, that we had to learn on the fly?
Well, I could start. I think, so when I finished my undergraduate teacher prep program, I was not prepared for a lot of things. As the, you know, the whole linguistically and academically, I knew what I needed to do. I got certified K through 6 elementary education, and then 7 through 12 Spanish. And I knew how to teach Spanish. I could teach anybody Spanish K through 12. And I could teach elementary ed K through 6. But what I didn't understand some of the cultural nuances. So I felt really, I had to learn that on the fly. My first experience, I got my undergraduate, and I had a lot of classroom experience. So I was really fortunate that I was in the classroom in bilingual program in Dunkirk, New York. So I felt like I got my feet dirty, you know, in that. And then I went to teach in Houston, Texas, and the students were very different, and I was in shock. And I made some errors in understanding what was misreading some of the cultural things. And I worked in with other diverse populations as well, a lot of Vietnamese Laotian students those first 2 years. And, you know, there's just little things that you could offend students without realizing you were offending them. Rubbing a little boy on his head and he didn't talk to me for 3 months. I didn't learn that in my undergraduate. And then to talk about my graduate in bilingual special ed, I really felt there was a focus on my training there on looking at assessments and how to assess students. Then when I actually got myself in the career where I was, I didn't do that at all as a special ed teacher. That was a school psychologist job. So, you know, I felt that I could have more conversations with them about it, but I also experienced a little bit of, oh, well, that's what I do. You just take care of the classroom instruction, give us the teacher input form, but leave the determination, whether it's a disability or not, up to me. And so, you know, those are some things that happened in my teacher prep program that, you know, I really feel we need to do a better job of culture in general. And then I also think we should bring more of the assessment piece. I got my graduate degree in Connecticut, Fairfield University. So it wasn't a New York thing. And some of the bilingual special education master's programs, how much they really do on assessments, or if they leave that to another. But there again, bringing in those, minimizing the silos, having that experience so that teachers know more about the assessment piece, more about the cultural piece, I think will be better equipping some of the teachers.
I remember wishing almost immediately when I left graduate school that I wished that the American Speech Language Hearing Association allowed master's degree programs that were suited to fit where you were going, because there's such a range in what a speech language pathologist can do that I got one course in, just a couple of classes in one course around, bilingual students or what culturally responsive education is. If I even had it at that time, I don't think it was as much of a thing that was brought to light in our degree program. I spent time in courses on, some significant medical stuff that I never will use again, So I remember immediately wishing I wish I could have gone back and got my master's degree in speech language pathology for someone who's going to work in a school-based position, because I think they could have expanded a lot more on the issues that we see. One of the biggest things I remember being the most surprised about when I started clinical practice were the behaviors. Because when you work with kids who have difficulty communicating their wants and needs, if they don't have the speech or the language skills to do it, guess what they use instead? They're gonna swat you and they're gonna bite you and they're gonna fight you. That's because that's the only thing that they have in their toolbox to be able to get their wants and needs met. And we didn't take a single course in, behavior management of any kind or understanding what challenging behavior looks like or how to address it. That was shocking to me. And I still have scars. If you've ever worked in special education, you've got scars, like you do, like real ones. And that I remember was an area that was never quite addressed, and definitely a shock. Even as we were talking before, the fear about going into CSE meetings, even when you work in special education, you're not prepared for what that looks like. And it looks different in every school district and building. So one experience doesn't necessarily mean you'll have the same one at the next school you go to. So regulations, like there's just so much that you have to learn on the job. There's no other way to learn it. They could design course after course after course, but unless you're in there and doing it, you don't learn it the same. So.
Yeah, I have some similar recollections of my own teacher prep program. And I'm like, maybe I'm just forgetting that I was taught these things, but maybe not. Like I'm thinking about, I wish I had been shown what an IEP looks like. I went to a SUNY school and I wish that I knew what that looked like. I feel like my prep program did a good job of teaching us about like the historical legal context of supporting multilingual learners, but I didn't know a ton about New York regulations, you know, in terms of what NYSED said for English language learners, and I knew nothing about special education regulations. I feel like knowing the regulations is so powerful. It gives a teacher so much more strength when they're advocating for a student, and I wish that I had known that. Mm-hmm. And I'm thinking kind of along the same lines, Lourdes, like, I feel like there was a lot of theoretical focus, but there wasn't a lot of like, okay, when you're actually in the classroom and this happens, like, how awesome would it have been to be able to role play? Like, that would have been really helpful for me to kind of do that and like, see, like, okay, we're having someone represent a student who is exhibiting this challenge or this behavior or whatever. So what are some ways that we could do that? That would have been really helpful for me. And I think even in a preparation program to become an ENL teacher, I don't feel like there was a lot of focus on understanding cultural nuances. I feel like there could have been at least some kind of acknowledgement that, like, okay, even if your students are majority Spanish speakers, do you know how many countries speak Spanish, and you know how many cultures speak Spanish, and you know how different that is? Because my Puerto Rican students are not the same as my Dominican students, as my Mexican students, as my students from El Salvador. Like, there are so many huge differences. And I did not, I don't know, I feel like there wasn't even a focus on, like, okay, you have ENL students who speak five languages in your class. It was just like, you have ENL students. And like, so there's this monolithic group of kids, right, which is so untrue, because even if I only taught Spanish speakers, they're all different. They all come from different cultures. And I'm like, why didn't we talk about that?
Yeah.
I did a lot of like theory of learning how to read and stuff like that, but you know.
Yeah. And I'll say too that, I finished my graduate degree in 2010, 2011. And even then, I feel like when we were exposed to the idea of students who were, you know, bilingual or English language learners, the messaging that kind of, the way that it often landed was, that's an issue for those kids in those zip codes. So you're only going to have to deal with that if you choose to go into that, like, into that kind of setting. So we'll, like, you'll figure it out. That it definitely was kind of the messaging that was sent, that this isn't, I wouldn't worry about it. Like, we're not going to address this because, you know, most of you are probably going to go work over here where it's majority white students, and that's going to be fine. And that's not the case. And it's in a lot of ways, we are seeing a consistent growth in the diversity and in our school buildings, even in historically predominantly white school buildings. So we're really looking at a massive increase in need for culturally responsive training, in addition to training around students who are maybe speaking more than one language.
So thinking about what we didn't learn and what we wish we had learned, what would you encourage pre-service teachers to do to prepare themselves for serving students who are diverse in a multitude of ways, not just linguistically, but ability-wise, culture? What would you say to pre-service teachers?
That to me is so primary, because we tend to overlook the gifts and the strengths that students bring, because we're so focused on their needs and what they can't do. Let's look at what they can do. Let's celebrate with them what they can do. Let's enhance them. Let's help students feel like they have something to contribute, no matter what the levels of deficits are. You know, so that's the first thing that's on my mind about that.
And I heard you say the other day, Lourdes, that it's our job to find the treasure in our students. And that really resonated with me. That's our job.
It is our job. And, you know, and sometimes we get stuck because we only have one part of the lens. So we would look to our colleagues and they might find, you know, their part of the lens. And then we come together. It's like, wow, they can do that. I didn't realize that. So, you know, it's really, I just think that is what we need to do. So thank you.
And the other thing I would recommend is don't wait to graduate. to attend professional learning opportunities because you want to expand the scope of what you're hearing because even college programs, those are culturally constructed. So you are getting messaging that is based on whatever the culture of that university and that program lends itself to. So don't be afraid to sign up and go to a training. Like, I know I was like, oh, I can't do that. There are people there who know more than me. There are people who've been practicing forever. Like, I'll just look silly. No, go, because how often can you, you know, get an opportunity to hear from somebody outside of your normal circle, making those networking connections and learning something from a different point of view or messaging than you've been used to hearing for the last 4 to 6 years.
Yeah, I think I would say diversify your who you follow, who you read. That would be my advice. Kind of in the same vein, Kelly, with what you were saying, universities are funded in different ways and have different agendas. And I think that if you really want to have a wide perspective before you get into the classroom, seek out voices that you wouldn't normally be exposed to in your learning, who are addressing these topics in our field, because that's the only way you can learn other perspectives. Is there anything else, ladies, that you would like to share with the listeners about supporting our students who maybe just need English language support, maybe need speech language support, or maybe need multiple types of support? Anything else you wish our listeners would know about this topic?
One of the things I want to say, and maybe it's a little off the topic, but we have so many students that are multilingual in our high schools, and we have such a shortage of personnel that speak multiple languages to be able to provide speech language services, school psychology, education, special education, OT, PT, we really can be doing a better job of guiding students into some careers that they already possess the second language that we're looking for supports in helping us, you know, evaluate students. So if we're saying assessments need to be in multiple language, is instead of going to interpreters to help us, let's create bilingual school psychologists that speak 2 or 3 languages, because our students are graduating and not knowing where to go. Or they might even be not graduating yet, but still wondering, what can I do with my life? And if they can see that their language is an asset and they can learn these other skills to support, I'm a product of that. I didn't think I was going to be a bilingual special ed teacher or bilingual teacher when I was younger, but you know, I have no regrets that this is where my career path has taken me. And I mean, I know we have some of that, but I really want to encourage that. So if there's anyone listening that's got students that they think, let's get into bilingual school psychology, or you might be a monolingual speaker and you say, I could learn more of this language, so I could take more language in college, I could travel, I could be, you know, some people learn a second language in the Peace Corps or VISTA or other places and then bring that back into their, you know, because even on this continent, we need to be able to have multilingual supports, I believe. So.
Yes, I love that. Call to action.
Yeah.
That's well, the research supports that they're more likely to get jobs with higher pay and maintain them. So why not? Why not push them in that direction?
Any final thought?
Yeah, we'll just have more accurate assessments because folks that will know the language will be doing the assessing.
And we'll be moving toward a multilingual dual language programming and away from monolingual education, which is really where the gap lies. So the gap does not lie with our multilingual students. I heard somebody say at Midwest Auburn at a session that the gap exists because there are monolingual students. The gap does not exist because there are multilingual students. So if we can encourage our multilingual students to go into fields like bilingual education, bilingual psychologists, bilingual special education, then we'll be moving closer to that more equitable system where multiple languages are used in school. And that's just my little spiel there.
I love it. And I guess the only other thing I would add as we kind of consider wrapping up is keep on keeping on. As hard as this job is, it is so incredibly important, and your students need you, and their families need you, and I am just really proud to be a part of this profession, and want to reiterate to anyone who's listening that as hard as it is, and as hard as this year in particular has been, you are needed, you are valued, and you are appreciated more than you could possibly know. Keep going.
Great way to end.
Yeah, what better way to end? Nothing can follow that. Thank you, Kelly. Thank you, Lourdes.
Thanks for having us.
Yeah, thanks for having us. It's been a pleasure.
Awesome. Bye.
Bye. Bye.
Thanks for listening today. If you would like to learn more about the brilliant guests we had on today's episode or any of the resources we discussed, please find those on our webpage. This podcast is produced by Midstate Arburn at OCM BOCES, and our theme music is Sunbeam from Purple Planet Music. We hope that you'll tune in next time for more of Our Burning Questions.